going to use a two-fluid model. Okay, this will work better if I take the tag off. So this work on the clock ambiguity is work that I started in the 90s. There's three papers about it, and I've been taking it up recently with a postdoc, Alberto Iglesias. The outline for today is I will tell you what it is. I will talk a little bit. It's kind of weird. And so the first question you would ask is how should you do physics once you see the result from here? And then I will take some steps in trying to sort of proceed with the ideas I propose in part two. So the starting point is the superspace formalism that's often used to think about quantum gravity. And you typically start with in some superspace a Wheeler-DeWitt equation that tells you the whole Hamiltonian annihilates the state in superspace. And then what you do in this kind of picture is you find an internal clock, a time variable that's internal to the system. And that amounts to saying that your superspace can be divided up into the clock subsystem and the rest. So this is the clock, and this is the rest. And then you consider, so I will proceed in a kind of schematic way where you say, OK, let's imagine a basis that spans this subspace and a basis that spans this subspace. And I'm going to suggestively give a time label. Really, this is just some index I labeling the states, the basis spanning the clock subspace. And then we consider a set of a basis spanning the rest. And with these bases in hand, we can expand the original state. So we can write the state in superspace in some expansion. I'll keep the sentimental T here just to remind us what we're thinking about. And so we have this expansion. And then the time evolution of the system is described in a conditional probability form where you ask if the clock is at in state whatever, what is the state of the rest of the system? And it's convenient to define, let's call it phi, just to be clear, phi of ti and the rest is equal to, it's just summing, keeping I fixed and summing over j. And so basically, these objects give the time evolution. If you want to know the state of the rest of Ti, this is it. You just project onto the state of the clock you want and find out what the rest of the system is in. And this is just an outline of a standard, one standard approach to thinking about quantum gravity. And actually, this is, you know, Tom thinks differently now, but he's one of the pioneers who's written papers realizing this, for example, in using the scale factor of cosmology. And Jim Hartle is one of the pioneers of this, these kinds of thoughts as well. Although Tom, I find, is one of the people who most forcefully doesn't want to think this way today. And actually, one of the points I'll make at the very end is that it's intriguing to me that the place I get to thinking through these issues is more similar to the kinds of ideas I hear from Tom than I would have expected, just a priori. So I'll leave that as a footnote for later. So what you do, for example, is if you want to know sort of probability of finding the state in the rest in some state X at time T3, for example, you just do the usual inner product with psi. Sorry, I need to write phi here, but T3. And because it's conditional probabilities, you just square this. And one of the interesting things from this conditional probability approach is that if you look at it this way, you automatically get unitarity, because at any given time, the rules of conditional probabilities allow you to normalize for free, really. So
the space is implicitly the space is closed. For example, suppose the spacetime was asymptotically flat or asymptotically ADS. There's time at infinity. So your thoughts, are they constrained to sort of track that time?
So still are. So I'm taking a view. So one of the things I'm doing here is I'm putting all these discrete indices on things. Yeah. And I'm taking the view that some physicists like to do to say, well, for all practical purposes, for all I know, the world is finite and countable. And I'm just going to, you know, make it as fine, take as large a space as I need to approximate all these continua that I'm thinking about. But I'm going to allow myself this convenience. Now, I also want to put a footnote there. That was one of the points I was going to make, which is you may later decide there's something deeply wrong with doing that. But I want to get to it. I'm going to raise that question myself few steps down the line, but for right now, I just want to allow myself this schematic picture to show where it goes to, and I think it's an interesting question whether I've lost something important by a simple-minded picture.
So, I hope you don't mind some technical questions as you go along. So, I mean,
let me just say that's what I would prefer. So, I prefer as many interruptions as you feel.
Okay. So
we can do that.
Yeah. So assuming, look, let this be, you know, a real theory of quantum gravity. You know, we can do 2+1 gravity coupled to point particles, which is well understood, which is pretty well understood. We can do some version of quantum gravity. What are you assuming about the inner product? For example, are you assuming that in this decomposition, are you assuming that the original state psi is normalizable in some inner product, and are you also assuming that the decomposition is such that there is an inner product on the space R, such that phi is normalizable?
Yeah, I'm assuming all that.
Have you thought about how constraining that might be?
A little bit, but I'd like to talk, you know, that might be a good thing to talk more about. So I know these are issues, and I'm kind of glossing them over.
Does your answer to Lee mean that you're thinking of this original psi that satisfies H psi equals zero to live in space with a positive definite number?
Yeah. I have to assume that to play all the games that I'm doing down the line. And so I'm granting myself that so I can do simple linear algebra stuff, you know, span it with, you know, define these expansions and bases and all that.
We'll just ignore the fact that, say, simple mini superspace, versions of the Miller-DeWitt equation. That's not true. Right, the space of solution of h psi equals 0 is not a Hilbert term.
For now. Yeah, we can come back to that. I'm not sure it's going to undermine what I'm doing. Okay. But I don't want to try to figure that out.
But then asymptotically, aren't there extra terms than surface terms? Straight? Right. Corresponding to time translations.
So I'm kind of butchering that by making discrete finite and
so these are spatially compact.
Yeah.
Okay. I think that's an easy way to say it.
Yeah.
You're assuming it's
spatially compact. And you're making some assumptions about the causal structure of the space-time, globally hyperbolic or no place-time by broad lines or something.
Well, I'm going to really butcher all of that. So I'm assuming it's finite. I'm assuming I can whatever I'm thinking about these sort of continuum ideas can be expressed by something that's finite and discrete.
But to be clear, there's no thing. This is some version of quantum gravity, so there is no space time.
Right.
This is not living.
Right. So this is supposed to be some more fundamental formulation. So now, so we've just covered the point that I was going to raise, which is you may have questions about this formalism. I'm just going to plow forward, and then we can look at where it gets us, and then maybe these questions become very to the point a little bit down the line. And it'd be very interesting to me if some of these simplifications wind up being
equation. The thing in the denominator also has R's on it.
Yes. Sorry.
Thank you.
So my claim now. So all the information. So we've chosen a decomposition into clock times rest. That decomposition has resulted in these expansion coefficients, alpha ij, and actually all the information about the state and its time evolution in the rest subspace is given by these alpha ij's. Now my claim is that by a suitable alternate choice of clock decomposition of the choice of these two subspaces, I can find any alpha ij's that I want, and absolutely any alpha ij's, and therefore the state and its time evolution are completely controlled by the choice of decomposition here. And I'll show that. So to start with, we can just imagine, so consider some new state in R with new time evolution. And that just means some alternative alpha ij. So consider anything you want. So right now we're sticking to the same decomposition. I just say, well, if you want a new state from the time evolution, choose a new state in the superspace that gives you what you want. And that ends up meaning you need a new alpha ij. Now,
and in general, the alphas are rectangular matrices, and the dimensions of the two indices are anything you choose.
Yeah. And so now I'm going to take this. So different people have different intuition about how the next steps go, and I'm going to take a very pedestrian kind of slow process and
pardon me if I insult your intelligence, but I find a couple of little crutches helpful along the way. So I'm now going to construct. So you give me the idea is you give me the alpha ij prime you want, and I will show you how to find an alternative decomposition that yields that alpha ij for the new for the original state in the superspace. So right now we're talking about a new state in the superspace that yields this decomposition. So the primes appear on the alphas, and everything, and there's a new state in superspace, but the decomposition is the same. And now I want to say, well, consider some operator that takes the old state into the new state in superspace. We can construct at least one of these. That shouldn't be a problem. So I just want to describe the relationship between the new and the old state, and I'm going to use this operator on this equation. But the first thing I'm going to do actually is I'm going to define this may be too pedestrian, but we're going to do it. I'm going to define a basis in the superspace that's just equal to how do I want to do this? Well, yeah, I'll just write it and explain it. So we have this is defined by some one-to-one relationship between I and J and K. So you can this is discrete and finite. You can label it with two indices, or you can label it with one. Is basically all I'm saying, with some particular mapping from the two index version to the single index version. And I'm doing that just so that I can do the following. So some operator that maps this one into that one. So I take yeah, I'm not so I think if you want it to it can, but I'm not sure that's gonna matter. So I write down my make sure I get this right here. So I have so I start with this. I can just as well label alphas with the K. And I then operate with M inverse. So it has to be invertible. That's one thing. And then I define this as a primed basis. And so and this becomes the original psi. So I get this, and then I can use invert this mapping to define the new decomposition. Clock prime, rest prime. So I've just stepped through some steps. Where you've given me, so I've chosen some particular state in superspace with the intention of describing a particular system evolving under a particular time evolution. And then you said, well, what about a different state evolving under a different time evolution, resulting in alpha ij prime? And I've showed you how to find a different clock rest subdivision of the superspace in which the same state I originally used now has the new alpha ij, the alpha ij prime, describing the state and the time evolution in that new subdivision of clock and rest. So this is the result. So the result is that you give me a state in superspace, and I can choose a clock times rest interpretation that will give me any state evolving according to any time evolution I want, or ones that I don't want as well. There's complete ambiguity as you go from superspace to a picture of time evolution due to the choice of clock. Now, I want to talk about why I care about that. Because for example, you could walk into a laboratory in a physics department, and you could see a theorist and an experimentalist talking together about whether some theory fits something that's happening in the lab. And I could walk in and I could sort of look over the theorist's shoulder and I could say, well, that's very interesting. You have these parameters, you know, describing the electrons in the sample and these parameters describing the walls of the sample. Why don't you mix those up and think about some other combination of those parameters describing the electrons and some other combination describing the walls of the sample? And they just throw me out, rightfully so, because that's not the point of what you do with quantum mechanics in the laboratory. You're setting up your theory with a specific idea of modeling a specific thing with specific variables. And that's what you do. And this kind of playing around doesn't have any place in ordinary applications of quantum mechanics like that. The reason I'm willing to consider this is things that happen in cosmology, where it's often the case that people are trying to, the people don't think the sort of relevant classical picture of our cosmology is something that gets extracted directly from the fundamental degrees of freedom, but rather people are looking for ways the fundamental degrees of freedom produce some emergent phenomena that ends up looking like our universe. People have said things about space and time being emergent. People, you know, there's all kinds of versions of that. There's Jim has a long-standing agenda of looking for how classical behavior emerges. In eternal inflation, you can have different degrees of freedom becoming a classical Big Bang in different ways. The inflaton can roll. So there's lots of ways in cosmology you wind up, one way or another, sifting through your fundamental degrees of freedom, looking for which degrees of freedom are going to behave like our world. And it's in that context that I find this interesting. Because it would seem to me that one of the things you ought to be doing is taking an agnostic view of which thing you might call a clock. If you have a state in a superspace that's supposed to be your fundamental description of the theory, one of the things I'd expect you to do is dig around for different possible clocks and consider every possible clock as a contender for describing a physical piece of the multiverse, or whatever you want to call it. And what I find remarkable is that this shows that your process of choosing that clock results in total ambiguity about what the actual physics is, the state and the time evolution. So specifically, you could work very hard to do lots of accelerator experiments and other experiments and work out exactly what the Lagrangian is for the world as we know it, and feel accomplished about that. But if you then try to make that part of a fundamental theory that's described in this sort of formalism, all that hard work goes completely out the window, because I can, as I go shopping for possible clocks, the particular Lagrangian, the particular Hamiltonian that you came up with to describe laws of physics as we know it, would just be one of the many possible things that come out as I go shopping for clocks in this formalism. And it wouldn't be called out. So a priori, you wouldn't have any reason that that would be more important than any other possible laws of physics. Well, Lee first.
Oh, I'm sorry.
So this is very interesting, but I would worry more if it was a stronger result of the following form, and maybe you're about to show it. So among the approaches to emergence of time and time dependence, space-time, and there's several to choose from, but one of them is Rovelli's. And Rovelli's program is roughly the following. One looks not at solutions, but at the observable algebra. So one, first of all, has to look at the algebra of operators on the Hilbert space, and this does assume that it is a Hilbert space, that commute with the Hamiltonian constraint, because those are, as well as the other constraints, because those are space-time diffeomorphism invariant. And one looks amongst those operators for operators that can be interpreted as speaking of correlations, and roughly speaking, what's the value of some operator R when some operator T is T. And of course, this is technically very, very challenging, but it can be carried out in various kinds of models. And one proceeds by saying, I'm interested in a particular clock, and some particular degrees of freedom that I'm going to call a clock. And one wants to know what are the correlations between the readings of that clock, of the operator that measures that clock, and other operators. And one has to construct operators which are physical operators on the physical Hilbert space to construct them. So in that setup, there certainly is some freedom to choose what you call the clock. But I think the claim would be it's no more and no less than the freedom that we actually have as experimentalists to decide to record correlations between some degrees of freedom and other degrees of freedom that we take as useful clocks.
Right. So what I think you said space-time continuum somewhere there. And what I'm doing is not, but through this.
No, this is all in the context that you're talking about. I mean, give a specific.
But I'm willing to make this by making it, well, Leah, so one question I've not resolved for myself is how much of this carries over if you allow for more continuum behavior. But in this discrete picture, I have no particular dependence on one particular notion of space-time. I can look for that to emerge, but I'm willing to butcher a particular notion of space-time that may have gone into defining this to begin with to extract a new clock that may be some mixture. I mean, the new metric may be some mixture of fields and metrics and.
No, let me say it a different way. This is a result about a state, and it's an interesting result. It's a disturbing result, and it is true if we believe, you know, it is true that there is one universe, so maybe we're only interested in one state. But in quantum mechanics, we're interested in observable algebras and Hilbert spaces, and it might be that you could posit a stronger result at the level of operators, and that stronger result would not be true. That is, one could posit at the level of operators that the Hamiltonian as constraints as an operator splits into some time operator plus a Hamiltonian for the rest of the system. Mm-hmm. And then the analogous question would be, given fixing the Hamiltonian constraint, can you get any Hamiltonian you like? So one isn't just following the evolution of one state. The question is, you know, following one of the several different ways to take a semi-classical approximation to a quantum theory of gravity. Can one get any Hamiltonian one wants for the matter center theory?
Well, I think I'm just going to go forward with this, and we can see if it. I don't see how it's going to deviate from those ideas. I'm not sure. You're sort of. It sounds like you're basically saying this is the evolution of one state, but a Hamiltonian has to tell me about all the states. And
you have a longer result, which in which the notion of dynamics is dependent on some decomposition at the level of operators and not at the level of an individual state.
I don't think so, but I'm going to use this fact that this is not a whole Hamiltonian a little bit later. You can see how I use it, and then maybe you can come back to your question. Jim, you had you were starting to say something.
Yeah. Well, I'm just going to ask about whether the separability of the Hilbert space is being assumed a kinematic one. Because my understanding is, at least from some experts in loop quantum gravity, that the kinematic Hilbert space, with some inner product they construct, is not separate. Is that right?
That's before you modify spatial diffeomorphism. So there's a fictional non-physical Hilbert space, which is used in the construction of the diffeomorphism invariant Hilbert space, spatially diffeomorphism invariant Hilbert space. And that fictional or Hilbert space is not separable, but the space of diffeomorphism invariant space is separable.
Spatial?
Yeah.
Okay, I would draw the question.
Okay. And so I'll just leave hanging the question that this on the face of it is a disturbing result, although it's kind of one of the things one of the interesting pieces of working on this has been for me to do some soul searching about why I think it's disturbing, and I decided part of the reasons it was disturbing were not particularly flattering to my intellect. so we can talk about that over coffee or something, but certainly on the face of it, it's disturbing, and I would, I would say that maybe what we want to do, maybe the way that is resolved, that discomfort is resolved, is by challenging the formalism I've used in some way, maybe looking more closely at what I've assumed about norms or about the discreteness, maybe looking at the continuum, what I've done to the continuum more closely. And I'm very open to that. I think any one of those outcomes would be very interesting in terms of sort of finding that this simple picture has some important pieces missing that helps understand what you really got to do to do this right. So that I'm happy to sort of put that on the table as a topic to work on. But for the rest of my talk, the part where I'm talking, anyway, I'm going to assume this is what we have to live with. I'm going to ask the question, suppose we have to live with this. Suppose this is really how physics works. What do we do? How do we do physics under these conditions? And so that's part two. Any other questions about part one before I go on to part two? So if we have a talk ambiguity, how do we do physics? And somehow, with the clock ambiguity, all states evolving according to all possible time evolutions are present in the formalism. And we have to ask, if this is going to have any predictive power, we have to have some means of searching around for decompositions into clock and rest. And we have to ask ourselves, how do we evaluate these decompositions? And at the end of the day, when we sift through all possible ones and maybe subject them to certain conditions that we feel are appropriate to apply, is there some
predictive power in a statistical sense? Does the distribution of laws of physics come out to be peaked, sharply enough peaked, that we actually feel we're making predictions at the end of the day, even though it looks like that's the last thing we could do? Now, the way I, so there's actually a number of, so in the papers that we sort of talk about a number of different things you might want to put in, and you know, the arrow of time is a favorite topic of mine, and we talk a little bit about how that might be important here. But for today, I want to just focus on one particular piece of this that I think is especially significant, and that is the observed fact that, you know, and this is, you know, we're being anthropic to some degree here, so I'll just get that out in front. But I think trying to be anthropic in a very disciplined way, and I just want to say that the key point here is that we, a critical part of our existence is that we are tiny observers who are able to exist and thrive in a universe that has many, many more physical degrees of freedom than those of ourselves, and we're able to cope with that very well. And the word I use to go with that is quasi-separability. The Hamiltonian of the universe can be, is approximately separable. Our, my self-Hamiltonian is much stronger than my interactions with the stick or the chair or Pluto or whatever. And that allows me to maintain my identity, persist over time, have very manageable, controllable interactions with the rest of the world. And that's a very special property of the universe. So quasi-separability is what allows small observers that are a small part of the universe to manage in the universe as we know it. And I'm willing, and I want to just take that as an observation. So maybe there's other kinds of observers that are the whole universe, there's other kinds of observers that are doing something differently, but I want to find out what are the typical laws of physics for an observer that manages to be a small piece of the universe. And to do that, the physics has to allow me to have a strong interaction with myself compared to the interactions with many other objects. And the way our universe achieves that quasi-separability is through locality. So writing a Hamiltonian like this is very, very different from the general Hamiltonian you could think of. Why shouldn't I, you know, if you're just pulling a Hamiltonian out of a hat, why shouldn't, you know, the interaction with my thumb and the distant galaxy, why shouldn't that be the most powerful matrix element in the Hamiltonian? There's no, if you're really taking a random Hamiltonian out of the hat, there's nothing to say against that. So the fact that those interactions are highly suppressed is ultimately connected to the locality and also the state. There's other states in the universe that might, you know, maybe net charge states or whatever that might do something different. But the locality in our universe is how the quasi-separability is realized. I think I see a hand.
Why would it necessarily be locality rather than identity? Like you have principles, or you have principles in physics that are all of it there on the present. So why couldn't an identity still maintain its quasi-separability as an identity without being necessarily localized?
Well, I guess what I would say is that's what I mean by local. So you're going to have an identity. It's going to have some index. So which thing am I? There'll be some index that labels which identity I have. And then the quasi-separability says that those identities will interact in a controlled kind of weak way with each other. And that in itself does guarantee you're talking about space. It could be some other way of organizing that. But at this point, I'm saying just that the way our universe manages that is through locality, is through space. So that's just a fact of how physics works in our universe. And then I will add to that. So that's the kind of careful first part of my answer.
But then the more edgy part, which may be conflicting, is I have a conjecture, which you may not sit well with you, but a conjecture that this is in some sense an extreme realization of. This seems to me to be a very extreme sense of quasi-separability, because to some degree, sort of every point is, I mean, it's not exactly like that, but you know, there's lots of separable things. The sort of physics at every point is weakly coupled to other things, and that's seems like an extreme version of separability, of the quasi-separability we're talking about. Yeah.
Touched on a really important point here. It's another hidden assumption that goes into almost everybody's model of physical reality. And it was summarized many years ago by Hermann Bondi, I think maybe in his little 1952 book on cosmology, which is the important property of the world, that we can know something without knowing everything, that we can decompose our description of the universe, at least approximately, into manageable bits, bite-sized pieces. Otherwise, science...
It's extremely... And it's remarkable. If you're thinking about pulling a random Hamiltonian out of a hat, it's absolutely remarkable. I mean, a bus has many more degrees of freedom than I do, yet I have the capacity to model the bus sufficiently well that I can actually take it, you know, use it for some purpose of mine, rather than just be overwhelmed by all my interactions with the bus. And of course, the distant galaxy has even more degrees of freedom and I can totally ignore it.
Right, so it's a very deep property of work, a little bit difficult to pin down precisely what it is. But I suspect also that the linearity has something to do with it. The fact that we are the grossly nonlinear systems are rather unusual, rather rare. So I think as well as locality, quasi-linearity.
Right, and to me, that's a piece of how... You know, it's definitely a piece of how the interactions are small between these systems. You can imagine some nonlinear, even if there's some notion of space, nonlinearity could destroy the separability you might gain from that.
Right.
Yeah. So I agree completely with that. Yeah.
Well, just as a comment, though, it's not true of all physical systems.
Yeah.
I mean, nuclei are a good example, right? So
they're small and they're short-range fossils.
Well, they are, but I mean, to understand the nucleus, it's very difficult to understand it as just the sum of its parts, because when you put them together, they interact. So I think what's even more curious is that some systems are quasi-separable, but not all. And the trouble with physical reality is we do this because it helps us solve the problem, but it may not be true. We don't know if this is actually gonna...
Well, we're doing very well by making this.
Sure, but I mean, on some larger scales, I mean, maybe... We can't have everything we want.
But in the example of nuclei, you were just looking at the wrong quasi-separable degrees of freedom. The degrees of freedom that...
Neutrons and protons work out fine.
The locality postulate are the fields of QCD, right?
Well, neutrons and protons work out fine, but the structure of the nucleus is far more complicated than just sticking neutrons and protons together. That's my point.
I agree. I think all that's true. Yeah. But there is even a local, there's QCD that helps you, but then it's strongly interacting, so there's not a naive extrapolation.
It's still completely local.
But it's still local. Right, but I think that's actually an example of how locality is not enough. The locality of QCD doesn't help you understand what's really separable, what's quasi-separable. Yeah. Because a given quark at low energies isn't really separable. To get the sort of benign locality that helps you separate things, you have to talk about protons and neutrons, whatever.
About states that are created from the vacuum, like agent-invariant local operators.
But you still, anyway. I think we can agree about how QCD works, and it is. There's pieces of it that give the quasi. There's certain things that have the quasi-separability you want, and some things that don't. And there's physics reasons why. You get some and not others. So this would be, I'm proposing that this is a real driver for what happens if you live in a world where you have to fish around for clocks and ask, is this a good clock or not? An important driver is going to be, does it exhibit quasi-separability? Are there some, you wind up with a time evolution for the rest of the universe that allows you to separate it out into subsystems that are more or less on their own, not completely, but weakly interacting with other subsystems. And to me, I'm considering that as a possibly an idea of primary importance in interpreting theories with this kind of ambiguity. It at least starts to. Whether it's all you need, I don't know. It's one of the critical pieces of defining good clock, where good means good in its ability to, as a contender, to help us amass the ensemble of laws of physics that small observers might experience. So if we want to make a prediction of what, you know, we accept that we're tiny little pieces of the universe observing physical laws, what's the generic experience of tiny little observers observing physical laws? What kind of laws are typical? I want to start by putting a filter on. If I've pulled a clock out of the random ensemble that doesn't allow quasi-separability, I chuck it right out, based on anthropic reasons. Whether that filter is enough, how far that filter gets me is another question, but I want to start with that filter.
A reparametrization ingrained system is parametrized non-relativistic quantum mechanics. Right? Have you tried this criterion out?
I'll show you what I've tried next. It's not quite that. It's not that, but it's field theory. So let me show you what I've done.
Parametrized field theory.
So I'm not quite sure what you're asking, but it's easy to answer because I can show you what I have done. Well, I can show you what I have done in the rest of the talk.
Right, so, non-relativistic quantum mechanics. So
but I'm not sure. So at the end, we can talk about what I might do otherwise. But for now, I want to focus on what I have done. And then you can see if it's... I think what I have done is not is by no means complete, but it gives some hints about where this will go. Where this might go.
Can I ask a maybe tangential question about the quasi-locality? So at least in the context of field theory, whatever crazy physics or non-local physics might happen at some high scale, decoupling ensures that when I integrate down to low scales, I get a local theory. Mm-hmm. Is that true of generic Hamiltonians? It is known, but for generic Hamiltonians, if I coarse grain down, do I always get ultimately local theory?
No. I mean, a generic Hamiltonian may not even have a notion of space. So a generic Hamiltonian may not allow you to write it in this way. And at that point, I don't even know what that decoupling means. So I would say a priori not. But let's... I think that kind of topic might be easier when I've done some more of the steps up. Any other questions before I do that? Okay, so I want to go on to talk about field theory. And what I want to do is ask, so this is not a complete check. It's a certain kind of check you can do. And to be honest, what I thought would happen, so, well, for one, As I was pursuing this, I was constantly thinking this is totally ridiculous. I was not trained to think about physics in a way where we're pulling random laws of physics out of a hat. I've come around to think that I shouldn't have been thinking that way, but that is how I was thinking for a lot of this project. And so the thing I thought I was thinking would happen when we did this test was that it was a way to show what a problem this is, because what I wanted to do was say, okay, take the spectrum of energy eigenvalues of a field theory and compare it with the spectrum of energy eigenvalues of a random matrix. And not surprisingly, those are very different spectra. And that seemed to be where I could expect problems to start arising, but they actually didn't. So I'm going to tell you that story now.
And let me talk, let me tell you what I mean by what I'm thinking. So the idea is you pull some random laws of physics out of the superspace, and you see if they do a good job, a good enough job, of describing the world we see around us. And there's absolutely no need. So, you know, we have these quantum field theories, and they can describe a universe with just one particle in it, and they can describe a universe with, you know, that's at the Planck temperature, and they can describe all these things that we don't see. You could ask about cosmology and the, you know, early universe and all that, but the idea is to only check if the laws of physics that we extract are a good enough account of what we actually see. So we're not wedded to all the extrapolations of our, you know, equations in graduate level textbooks that could extrapolate to all kinds of conditions. We don't need to go all over the map with that. We just want to get a sufficiently good description of the world we see around us. So that's kind of different. And one of the things I was wondering about was gravity, and I was a little bit nervous. So black holes dominate the entropy of the universe as we know it. So in that sense, they dominate the states of the universe. And I was a little uncomfortable thinking that way in this context, because I'm not sure this analysis needs to devote all those states to black holes. Maybe black holes aren't really what we think they are. The black holes are not a critical, the details of the entropy of a black hole doesn't seem to be a critical part of our physical reality. It's kind of an extrapolation of the laws of physics that we know and love. But I wanted to keep a distance initially from needing to spend my whole time talking about the entropy of a black hole when that's really not the physical world that we experience every day. So I specifically focused on field theory, which is particles, sort of everyday particles running around in an everyday way. And what we'll see later in this talk is that I shouldn't have been so worried about the black holes. And then we're going to go back to in section 4 and get some hint that maybe we're a little bit, that I shouldn't have been so uncomfortable about that. But we'll see. I'll tell you what I think, and you'll see if you agree. It's just for.
And what do you take for capital A?
Capital H, the Hubble?
Well, the thing that's.
Okay, the Hamiltonian.
That's applied to the states gives zero.
Sorry, what do I think?
Well, to get back to the original equation, H psi equals zero. What's H for field?
Well, it's just a bunch of fields with. Oh, where's gravity? You're asking what's happened with gravity. I'm saying.
So we're not doing the original program, right?
Right. I'm just pulling random laws of physics, and whether in the end I identify metric and gravity and all that will come. Certainly at the linear level. Let me take a few more steps. And
what's the superspace, if you like? Let's forget about gravity.
Well, I can assume. So at that point, I assume I really put in gravity to the point of getting to superspace. But I'm being agnostic about whether when I pull it out, I see gravity in all these theories. So gravity has forced me to consider superspace in the first instance. But it's not necessarily true that I see gravity in every theory I pull out of it. That's the feature of this.
We're going to be able to make these decompositions in between.
It's just telling me I have to look for internal time. That's the one message I've taken from gravity as I know it, that I have to look for internal time. Once I accept that goal, I'm pulling out clocks at random. Some of them may describe the gravitating theory, and some may not.
In your general discussion with the general clock and so on and so forth, you get some time-dependent wave function. And there's nothing, I don't think, in that formalism that tells you in general that the time-dependent wave function satisfies a time-independent Schrödinger.
I will get to that. That's something that totally freaked me out. Until there's a really simple answer to it.
Okay, good.
But yes, that's something that was the most worrying part of all this to me for a long time. And then there's an astonishingly simple answer to that. So we'll get.
I'll get there. And it's related to one of the earlier questions, actually. So so what I do, so let's just, so I'm going to compare the spectrum of energy eigenvalues from a random Hamiltonian and a field theory. And so it turns out the theory of a random Hamiltonian has been worked out in great detail, starting with Wigner, and many other people have looked at this. And a number of people know this formula. I'm going to write it this way. So if we consider a space, a finite space with n dimensions, and build a Hamiltonian randomly out of it, we naturally there's going to be some maximum eigenvalue because it's a finite system, and I'm writing this in terms of the maximum value eigenvalue there. You could write it other ways. This is the size of the Hilbert space. This is the maximum energy, and this is called the Wigner. The Wigner semicircle, and this function looks like this. And sure enough, it's a semicircle. And this is E. So this is the result from Wigner. There's a lot of study that goes into what you have to assume about the distribution of the individual matrix elements to achieve this, but it's something like a central limit theorem thing where there's a lot of this from a lot of different distributions that, in the case of a large system, converge onto this result. So I'm just going to take that. So my logic is then to just accept this, that when I pull a random set of laws of physics out of the superspace, by far the most likely thing I'm going to see is this in terms of the Hamiltonian, in terms of the eigenvalues. So I'm just talking on the basis of the eigenvalues now, which is definitely not the full story, but that's where I'm focusing now.
N of R is the dimension of the
random of the random. So the R is, yes, the dimension.
And everything else is independent of N of R in this form.
Yes. Yes, it's only explicit. It only appears here. Yeah. Well, you could. I mean, it is related.
Some issue.
I mean, you could also say you could, for example, you could say that I'm drawing individual matrix elements from some distribution with some epsilon defining the scale, and then EM would be depend on epsilon and then R. The maximum.
Right.
So I'm just choosing, but since epsilon doesn't appear, I'm putting ER EM as the.
Okay.
So there's different ways you can think about it. But this is I can consider these to be independent in this picture without loss of generality.
Yeah. Well, if I think, for example, of the Gaussian random on this example,
right,
which doesn't really have an Emax, but effectively obeys the same law in the large N limit,
right, exactly,
then there's an issue of how I choose the coefficient in the Gaussian to depend on N, which sort of normalizes
right.
Scale.
Right. And then I guess what I'm saying is that by writing a formula this way, I've kind of absorbed that, because this is the thing I really care about.
Okay.
This allows me to work with convenient form.
Okay, so
and I agree with
this. The scaling so that this maximum is independent of it.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so that's the Wigner semicircle. And now I want to look at a field theory. And there's also some ideas about how that looks, not necessarily for the, you know, there's going to be questions about how interactions contribute and all of that. That's some of these notes. Here. And the I'll just use some
B is some constant of order unity. Likewise, with little b. So this is the general form. Where do I get this? Let me first tell you that the field theory regulator is delta k, which we can think of, if we want, in terms of a box that we've put the theory in. Basically, this is really a discrete picture. And the discreteness of our field theory is sensitive to the discreteness of the energy spectrum, which is related to some discreteness in k space for the field theory that you might have. And of course, for all we know, this is a continuum, and delta k goes to 0. But I'm just keeping it in to help with the discussion. And then a result that I know of from a paper of Tom's, I don't know if this is something you the standard, so I don't know if I'm supposed to name someone, or it's so standard that no one, so for a conformal field theory, we know that alpha is, where d is just the space dimension, has this form. And then there's a conjecture from Verlinde, which says that actually, if you include the Casimir energy when you look at this, that the that actually alpha of d is independent of d and is a half. And I've not considered carefully how I don't have a strong view about what's going on here and which one I'm going to choose. I'm just going to leave it as alpha for now, and we're going to see where that takes us. And this, of course, is an exponential. And the one thing you can see right away is that this doesn't look anything like this. So it seems like, as I was thinking all along, we're totally screwed at this point. But then what we did was we said, well, wait a second. We don't need to believe in field theory absolutely. We just need a good enough approximation to field theory to account for what we see. And so what we then did, what Alberto and I did, was just try to get these two curves to coincide order by order in a Taylor expansion and see how good the fit might be. And so let me just take you through that. So at zeroth order, so demanding zeroth order equality, I can probably do it here. So let me tell you an important point about what we did. Since we're sort of agnostic about what's happening with gravity at this point, we allowed ourselves, it's only in gravity that you care about an absolute energy scale. And we allowed ourselves not to care about an absolute energy scale. And we introduced an offset in the energy in this expression. And so we moved this, sorry if I'm abusing the edge here for some of you, but we basically replaced E with E minus E shift in this expression. So we're just allowing ourselves that degree of freedom. We're not trying to worry about the absolute energy scale at this point. And so then zeroth order equality we impose zeroth order equality and solve for the size of the random Hilbert space, and we get some messy expression that at the end of the day just tells us that NR has to be exponentially large, which might not be too surprising. We're expanding around some E naught, the universe, the energy of the universe, So the thing in these square brackets turns out to be not that important compared to this, which is the exponential couple of constants of order unity. So we have this, and we have the result that, we have to be working with a space that's exponentially large. And actually, since we know of no, for all we know, delta k goes to 0, we don't know of any discreteness in the spectrum of a field theory. This is really a, you know, if you're putting in particular values here, so what we're going to do is consider, well, how small do we know delta k has to be? And that's going to give us a lower bound on the number, the dimension of the space we have to be working with. And what I take to, so I look at this and I say, well, that's OK. We're going to have to. We're going to have to have a large space. We kind of knew that. You know, maybe you want to come back and ask why about that, but I'm not going to worry about that today. So I say, okay, well, this sort of worked out by the standards I'm using right now. And now we go to first order and demand first order equality. And at that point, we end up learning something about the shift. So, so first, then we also use the expression from zeroth order equality, and we get an expression which I'm going to regard as an implicit equation for the shift. And I'm going to just get this up here so we can talk about what it's doing for us. And the key point is that we have this difference in the denominator, which we're going to have to make very small to equate with the exponential on the other side. Well, it's not an exponential, but it's still a large number. This is the energy of the universe in units of the regulator here. So this is some very large number. We'll put plug-in numbers in the end. But what this tells us, get this, this is going to be very large. And what you're going to have to do is make this approach unity to get equality. And the way you do that is you end up having that the shift is equal to E naught. E m times 1 minus epsilon. So we need to bring this close together to make a large number over here. And that's what we end up doing. And since I'm allowing this shift for free, I'm doing okay. So at first and second or at zeroth and first order, by my standards, I'm doing fine with this comparison. And I, at this point, I can never resist making a completely unkosher comment, which is, oh, look, I somehow have a shift with the energy of the universe in it. And I'm just wondering if that has something to do with lambda, which, of course, I don't get to wonder yet because I haven't said anything about gravity. But it's just irresistible to blab that, and then I'll try to not, and then I'll try to stop blabbing about that for now. Yeah. Yeah. Tom asked. So I'm gonna. Oh, you know what? I can even hop, since we've had that question twice, I can hop to the answer. So, and it's connected to a point someone was making to begin with, that the so when we get the alpha ij's, they only tell us about one state evolving over time. And a Hamiltonian has to tell us what every state does. So there's insufficient information to define a whole Hamiltonian. And I can use that flexibility. So I could define many Hamiltonians that follow a particular time evolution. And what I can do is use that flexibility to require that I have a time-independent Hamiltonian. And that will work as long as I have one state evolving. I need n states evolving. So I have one nth of the information about a Hamiltonian. So I can take up to n time steps before I run into trouble assuming a time-independent Hamiltonian is an extra assumption. Now, I think that's a good kind of anthropic thing. I think observers are more likely to evolve with a constant Hamiltonian, the reliable laws of physics. So I'm quite happy to say that's part of my concept of what filter I'm putting on. And that means I get n time steps before I run out. And basically, you know, what's the time resolution of the universe? You know, maybe it's, you know, the age of the universe in Planck times or something. That's 10 to the 60 or something. Whereas this is an exponential of 10 to a large number. So we seem very safe doing that as a practical matter, as a fact of our universe. So we basically, our bounds on the discreteness of the energy spectrum are such that we seem to require many more states than we need, a much larger space than we need, just to get away with assuming a time independent Hamiltonian. So that's what I have to say about that. So I'm less worried, that's still an interesting question about how that plays out in the grand scheme of things. But for our universe, I think we're okay. But anyway, that's what I have to say about it. And now we can go on to the, I think I'm randomizing my pages here a little bit.
A sequence of vectors in the Hilbert space, I can think of that sequence of vectors as the repeated application of the same unitary transformation until I reach a number that's equal to the basis of the Hilbert space. After
the size, yeah.
Suddenly, equal to
the I run out of the ability to interpret it. Yeah. Right. So I run into trouble in the end. So it gets me in the end, but so far we happen to be safe, and that's probably a condition on what kind of stable laws of physics that can emerge. So now, at second order, so we've done zero from first. Second order, there is no equality. And one thing you can tell that right away, because the curvature is wrong. Second order is a curvature, it's wrong. So it's the wrong sign to begin with. So at second order, there is no equality, but we can define the difference. So at second order, we can look at the sort of percent difference between the two, sub 2 for second order, divided by the n v naught, which is equal for both of them, and this is approximately equal to the dominant term here is this one. And I've got it on the wrong board for what I'm going to do next. But anyway, this is a genuine difference between these two. And so now I want to ask the question, is this difference small or large? Is this large enough to present us with a contradiction already given what we know about the universe? Or is it below the radar in terms of the data that we've taken? Now, has anyone here been a kid or been around kids in England? If you have, you know about Blue Peter, and you are fond of the phrase, here's one I made earlier. And so here's one I made earlier. This is a table evaluating delta 2 for different guesses of what we might have for the different parameters that go into it. And if I were clever, I would have had the boards reversed so you could stare at the formula as well. Anyway, the energy of the universe is just the energy of the universe, density times volume. What might we choose for the scale of discreteness? Maybe it's the bound on the photon mass. Maybe it's the Hubble constant, you know, where you'd be putting a universe in a box the size of an observed universe. So it could be something like that. What's delta E? Actually, delta E is based on, delta E is set by 1 over delta T. So what comes in here is we're asking how well field theory works to describe physics as we know it. And delta E is the range of energies for which we want the field theory density of states to be accurate for it to work. And delta E, so how, what range of energies do we need? Well, the energy range is related to a time scale. So it turns into the question of what's the smallest time scale on which we're sure field theory works? And you plug that time scale in here, and we get the delta E here that we want to put into this formula. And so we can choose what we, you know, maybe it's set by accelerator physics. So far, accelerator physics hasn't told us we have to abandon field theory. Or maybe we want to think about ultra-high energy cosmic rays. That's a bit messier problem. It's not clear you can extract simple ideas of field theory necessarily. But anyway, we can look at these different numbers. And so with all these different choices, and a range of choices for alpha as well, which is this thing, I don't know, which happily I do still have the stuff on the board. We get this table. And for present purposes, I want this delta to be small. So if delta is small, it gives me some idea that it's OK to approximate field theory by this Wigner semicircle. And we see, so certainly, if we go with Verlinde with alpha equals a half, we're in great shape with delta being small. If we think more along the lines of a CFT picture, then three dimensions, we have alpha of 3/4, and you could say, ooh, that's large. But if you're optimistic, you could also be an optimist and you say, well, you know, these are very rough numbers. This is sort of the transition point. Maybe we're actually going to end up predicting the dimensions, right? Maybe, you know, so rough numbers, we're off by a few orders of magnitude. We're just about to discover the field theory doesn't work. So we're right at the transition here. And it's just, you know, three dimensions is sort of the largest number of dimensions we can afford and still get away with our benign ignorance about the fact that field theory is about to break down. You can take or leave how you interpret that. That's what you get with this rough estimation. Now, what does all that mean? I've mentioned, oh, I haven't just allowed myself to move forward with this and say what does it mean for the end. So let me just take a couple of minutes to talk about what we've done next. And the time's running out, so I'm going to just say it very briefly, and we can, you know, you can read it in papers or talk about it with me later. So this next step started with a very exciting thought that turned out to be wrong. And the exciting thought was, well, the second derivative of this thing is actually related to the specific heat. Maybe my good friend gravity, which causes gravitationally bound systems to have negative specific heat, is going to save my butt and tell me that I don't want something with that curvature, but really want something with this curvature. And that was kind of this happy thought, which turned out to be wrong. It turns out that the third derivative of the N isn't exactly the specific heat, it's related to it. And you can't just do it, you just can't have that simple picture. And actually, let me just say one other thing while I have these figures on the board. What we've done, so I've showed you equations, and what we've done basically is take that field theory curve and put it here. This thing being very close has to do with
I don't know if it's still on the board, yes, has to do with that 1 minus epsilon there. The epsilon is this sort of point of grazing here with the Wigner semicircle. And we are encountering a conflict with the curvatures of the two in second order, but that could be small. So what we did was instead of instead of looking at let me decide what I'm going to erase. Instead of looking exactly at n triple prime, which is a second order piece of this, we decided to look at S double prime, which includes n triple prime in its expression. And it was something we could, so we can evaluate entropy. So entropy, we can think of entropy of the universe as the sum of the entropy of the different components of the universe. And then we could differentiate it twice and ask, what is the entropy of the what is the entropy of the actual universe, and compare it with the entropy of the Wigner, the second derivative of the entropy of the Wigner distribution, which is minus 1/8. And we did it. We estimated S double prime for different components of the universe. We find that this particular quantity is actually dominated by S, the dark matter, S triple prime, which we estimate. So it's not, doesn't change the fact that the black holes dominate the entropy, but S double prime is something different. And it's plus or minus 10 to the minus 2 GeV. And let me yes, I'm just wondering what happened to the units. I have to say, I'm not sure what happened. I'm having a glitch right now. I'm going to have to. I'm totally confused what happened to the units here, I have to say, which is embarrassing. Because this should be. Well,
I mean, this has to be evaluated at this point.
Yes.
That you previously.
So the scale must be set by delta E or E naught, and my notes are wrong about this, and I can't reconstruct it in my head. I'll do it. If you want to stick around, we can investigate this. But the conclusion I drew was that these were comparable. The plus or minus is due to the fact we don't know if most of the dark matter is bound or not, so we don't know if the specific heat is negative or positive. But I did argue that this was in the right ballpark. Although I agree, there's something weird about what I've got on the board. I've got to go back and think a little bit better about how that works. So, this was our attempt to make a comparison. And I agree, kind of problematic at this point, but attempt to make a comparison, incorporating some aspect of gravity into this, which may or may not be the right way to do it. So let me just talk about conclusions. I'm actually really stunned that these ideas have survived as much as they have. I thought things would break down already at that level. And I think there's still many possible failure modes. And we could get all the way to get, for example, one missing link is that even if we get the energy spectrum right, there's still the question of how you extract observables, field operators or whatever, out of that Hamiltonian, and maybe there's going to be a statistical favoring of the wrong laws of physics, even at that point. So that's a whole area that we've not even discussed. There's lots of other
possible failure modes, but it's just a curiosity to me that we've gotten away with stuff, thinking this way as far as we have. Maybe you don't care about superspace and the clock ambiguity, and maybe it's just interesting to think about drawing laws of physics at random. I don't know. There was a time in my life, I mean, for a long time, I've argued that initial conditions are much more deeply and robustly understood if you can do it in a statistical way, rather than people standing up at conferences and arguing with each other whose wave function of the universe is better. I find that completely unexciting in its own right. And so if you can get a statistical picture for that, I've appreciated that. And you could ask, well, why shouldn't the same thing be true? I mean, if we wind up, doing the LHC and the little Higgs model is right, and someone wins a Nobel Prize, are we really, is that deeper than if we could show that a particular field theory was predicted on a statistical basis to be sharply, sharply peaked prediction from a statistical argument? We could ask, which is a more powerful insight into physics? If this is really the right way to think about it, we should actually be trying to make predictions for the LHC. You know, it's either right or it's wrong. And there's lots of ways it can be wrong, but if it's right, we should be running with it and taking it all the way. We're very far from getting to that point now. The most concrete ideas of stepping forward in smaller steps with this is, one thing that really intrigues me is, so Poincaré invariance enters this picture through the dispersion relation for the field theory, where we basically have energy going as k for high energies. And that's essentially where Poincaré invariance enters. And so one thing I would love to do is redo this calculation for some alternative to this, maybe with the some power law here or something, and see how it propagates through, and see if you can, in some sense, find some reason that the first power here is preferred. Then you might have an argument for why you have Poincaré invariance, which would be exciting. But I also want to think harder about gravity and how I have a number of ideas about what you might check to think about how gravity comes in. It's basically, in this picture, maybe the way to think about it is just, it's the metric, it's what the space, I mean, if you're getting a field theory, you're going to have space. How do you think about, in the most general way, about the metric of that space? So there might be interesting directions to go there. But that's where I'll end for today.
Very last point that you brought up. Isn't there any, so you're saying that if you were to leave Z as a free parameter for a dispersion relation and look for whether it is predicted to peak, for example, right. One, isn't there any structural assumption going into like that each wave identity over space that already assumes Poincaré invariance in the first place? Or is that not?
Have I secretly assumed? Well, since I haven't told you what I'm doing with this, I haven't. But it's a good question. I believe I could, imagine a free field theory with a different dispersion relation and try to get a formula like the one up at the top, but with Z appearing somewhere in it.
No, but I even meant, if you make no assumptions about the structure of the eigenvalue of the spectrum, you've seen them arbitrary in the other states. You haven't assumed any particular form.
So
then my presupposed Lorentz invariance. That's all I'm asking.
Well, I'm not sure I've got your question, but I'll try and answer you and tell me if I can. So we're asking which, so we admit that the laws of physics don't look like this, but we think that's generically what we're going to get as we pull laws of physics out of superspace. And what we're trying to find are the maximal, the most accommodating laws of physics to small observers that can be expressed by some piece of this curve. And maybe we'll find that when we try to fit it with field theories with different dispersion relations, we'll find some preference for z equals one. But I don't know. I don't know that off my head. I haven't been able to trivially come up with that as a function of z. So if someone here knows how to do that, I'd be very interested. But I don't know if I answered your question. You're looking like a capital. But
you don't have any misunderstandings.
Okay. Well, we can talk about it.
I had a question about your numbers. So if instead of plugging today's Hubble and so forth, you would plug a much higher value of Hubble, so that we're looking at what happens earlier in the universe, is a filthier, a better approximation or worse?
So Hubble is coming in through delta K.
Right.
So making Hubble smaller makes it worse. So you wind up asking the question.
Slightly.
Of course, the energy is well.
Yeah, it seems to me the density goes as h squared. If this is the total energy, let's say within the Hubble patch, then density goes as h squared.
H squared
times times your volume, which is 1 over h cubed.
Right.
The energy is
so h it's a 1 over h squared.
1 over h squared, yeah. Over
right. And so it makes it more difficult in the early universe. So so you could ask how early in the universe do you care about field theory? And maybe at the very least in nuclear synthesis you care, and then maybe you're looking at different, that's something to consider. I haven't thought about that in detail. I've thought about it in some other context. I've checked a few things about that and decided it wasn't too scary. But I'm also willing to be. I mean, you also have to ask the question, to what degree do we really have to believe the whole Big Bang? Although, how far back do we have to believe it in this thing? So I'm kind of soft on that. In nuclear synthesis, it would be a shame to abandon that, but I'm not sure I need it for any other purposes.
Well, let's thank Andy again.